The tunes are 75 and 9, the awesome Wendy's in their prime, the bowl is quick, the batsman fine. Remember? Do you remember? Nope, I can't remember, that was too long ago. Yeah. Holding Marshall, Garner, Lloyd, and Mighty Viv.
Mighty Viv.
They were going for the hat trick, the greatest team that lived.
That lived.
They swagger, then they stagger out. They shake their heads, they cry. How on earth did we lose to a team that played Yash Ball at five?
Are you still hungover from that champagne super over? Is there anyone who isn't? A better series finale than Game of Thrones, some said, but did the World Cup ever hit GOT levels over these 8 weeks? Talk about what it felt to be at Lord's on that magical Sunday evening and look back at the rest of the tournament. We have a full house in talking World Cup. I am Srinath Sripad and joining me is Osman Samiuddin, just about 45 days since predicting England's group stage exit at this World Cup. Hello, Osman.
Hi. Hi, everyone. I got that one right.
Andrew Miller isn't here, but he foretold the story of England's march to glory long, long ago before anyone could have called it. And it's my pleasure to welcome one of ESPN Cricket Post's finest for the first time, part of the Polite Inquiries Collective, Mel Farrell. Hey, Mel.
I like to be thought of as one of the finest. I don't think anyone else back there would agree with that, though.
Yeah, I'll leave that to Osman, who's better placed to judge.
Respectful silence.
Yeah, thanks for jumping in there, Oz.
Anytime.
Always. Alan Gardner, who had the unenviable task of writing the match report for that wild, wild final, is back in the house. Hey, Alan.
Yeah, hey. Hey. I haven't got much else. Still
catching your breath.
2 days on.
Okay, let's get the hyperbole out of the way first, Alan. You are... living in London, there's a World Cup win, Trafalgar Square is going wild, Lord's MCC members off their seats, absolute scenes, as Miller would say. Finest day in English cricket history?
Yeah, why not? Yeah. I mean, it was the utterly bonkers, of course, and that added to everything. The comparable thing, I suppose, is the 2005 Ashes, which was pretty fine occasion too. But yeah, we've won lots of Ashes series. That's an old hat, and this is the first World Cup. I mean, it was extraordinary, and the greatest game, the greatest ODI ever, and after. Not even managing to beat New Zealand, England have the World Cup. So, yeah,
magic.
Extraordinary.
So what was it like to be at Lord's for the World Cup final? Here's Akshay, an Indian fan who'd bought tickets thinking India would be there and ended up witnessing that game.
Right, so it's been nearly 4 hours since the craziest game that I've ever watched ended. I think being at Lord's to witness the madness... it has to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience, surely. I mean, I couldn't take that again. And that was even without India playing. I mean, as we got to the end of the game, there was not a soul left in Lord's who was still sitting, perhaps with the exception of those in yellow and red jackets in the members' pavilion. I mean, the tension was palpable, and the closer the game got, the more neutral I became, because really neither team probably deserved to lose today. And so as it went down to the wire and three runs of two balls and the Wade unfounded with the Wade unfolded with those two run outs, it was complete madness. And we didn't believe that come the super over again, we were left with three runs of two balls to get. And and they seemed to clarify in the crowd that for some reason, when if the match were to end in a tie, that New Zealand would actually lose, which seemed sort of unfair. But then... given the occasion and the overwhelming support, it seemed that any other result wouldn't happen. It's completely crazy day, completely mad end, and we're so lucky and privileged to be in there, seeing that, and that too largely tension-free, being a neutral.
Almost an injustice to not come to Mel and Osman first. You guys have witnessed to the occasion from the ground. Did you consider it a great privilege to be part of it? Have you been part of a bigger occasion, a more riveting occasion on such a big stage? Mel, your thoughts?
No, I said that then. I mean, it's not the first World Cup final that I've been to, and I've seen some amazing things, been to some other incredible ODIs. George DeBell and I were talking about some of the other ones we've been at that have just been amazing. You know, we've had last minute finishes and drama and, you know, games being won on the last ball, all sorts of things. But I've never witnessed anything like that, partly because there were times when we weren't quite sure what on earth was going on. And so there was a level of franticness to it, I think, that just made it all the more mad. And I've just never, ever felt anything like that. And I think everyone was just so invested in what was happening. You just couldn't take your eyes. I was actually feeling quite unwell. I was sat there. Osman will tell you I had his puffer jacket on and another jacket wrapped around me. And early in the day, I sort of had the cold sweat. So it just wasn't very well. But the adrenaline kicked in. I ripped off the puffer jacket and I was right to go by the end of it because the adrenaline hit was incredible. Good drug.
Yeah, totally. Great drug. As a lot of GIFs on Twitter would suggest, Osman, now two questions to you. The first thing I saw after the game, 15 minutes after the game, was your mail where you're still barely catching your breath. You didn't have a plan on what you were going to write. It almost felt like all of you were clueless, which is fair enough because nobody's seen anything like that. And secondly, there were so many questions around the rules and the overthrows and the super over and everything. Just out of curiosity, did everyone in the press box know what was happening? Did they kind of, sense that it was going to be won by England on boundary count, etc.?
You know, I have to be completely honest. As we were building up to that last over, there were some IC comms people sitting behind us. And there was Bazid Khan, you know, who's made a cameo on this show as well before. And they kept saying that, oh, this is going to go to the super over. This is going to go to the super over. And I was like, you guys are kidding, right? There's no such thing as a super over in one day cricket. Like, knowing that there was something in the back of my mind that said that, I think I read somewhere that they are going to have a super over in ODI cricket at the World Cup. And, you know, but not realizing that that's actually going to be needed at any moment in time ever, especially, like, you know, least of all at a World Cup goddamn final. To have a super over. So I wasn't, that was my level of knowledge at that time, and my level of expertise was, I wasn't even sure whether they were joking when they were talking about a super over. And then when the super over happened, I think somewhere during it, somebody said, again, I don't know who it was, somebody said that there's going to be a boundary count back at the end of it. And again, I was like, you've got to be kidding, right? Because, like, there's not going to be a tie in a super over. Like, what are you guys talking about? This is ridiculous. There's no way this is going to happen. And, you know, before that, I think we only started planning after that final ball. Like, we had, you know, a few cricket info staff in there. Thank you very much, ICC, by the way, for letting us all in. We had a few of them in, and everyone sat down. Jared, who's doing commentary, came downstairs, and nobody had any idea what they were going to write. We knew that we had to, like, write something, but no one had any idea at that time. I was going to actually ask Alan. I have no idea how he did this report and how many times he hit delete on that report before he sent in the final one.
In the bin.
Exactly.
Yeah, there were a lot of drafts, and until it got to the point where I stopped drafting them, and thought, I'm just going to wait and see what happens here. The rest will follow.
And eventually, it did. We got stellar copy out of it. No, but it was just, like, I don't think I've lived through, you know, forget sports. I don't think I've lived through a moment like that in my life. You know, and I'm the father of two kids, and, you know, had plenty of fairly exciting stuff happen to me in my life, but I don't think I've lived through anything remotely close to that. And I'm still, like, inside, I'm still buzzing from that final, you know. Like, the controversy of the finish and, you know, Miller's great story about the rule, which we'll come to, I'm sure. But even that, the drama of the game and the drama of the finish hasn't soured it for me. I'm sure it has soured it for a lot of Kiwi fans and you know, the Kiwi players and stuff. But for me, I'm still like, I can't believe we had a World Cup final like that.
Yeah, just to narrate to listeners what actually happened. The first things first, we'll put up a picture of six stunned Pick-N-Four journalists in the press box. Make sure to check out our thumbnail on SoundCloud. We'll put it up. There's Jared Kimber, there's Mel, there's Sambit, Sambit Bala, editor-in-chief, Osman. All of them stunned, completely clueless on what they're going to write. We'll make sure that's up. And secondly, just a couple of hours later, Andrew Miller, who we've alluded to a couple of times already, our UK editor, he dug up the overthrows rule debate in terms of whether Ben Stokes' deflected boundary should have counted for 5 or 6 runs. That debate rages on. Be sure to thank Miller for that. Coming to you, Alan, you do follow football. You watch some other sports as well. In some quarters, it's been written that this is the greatest tournament final ever. I'm sure NBA fans will talk about overtime and tournaments. Mel, I'm sure, can fill us in on that. But has there been a better tournament final? I was looking at World World Cup finals in football which have gone to sudden death, and I couldn't find any for starters.
No, I mean, I casting around for similar examples in any kind of sport, but I mean, I suppose like the, you know, the Champions League final of 1999, since we're talking about football, was a pretty extraordinary way to turn a game round in the last couple of minutes.
But it was a crap game.
I suppose United fans don't care about that, but and the finish is what makes it. There were probably some people that said New Zealand's innings was a bit forgettable at Lords.
Henry Nicholls stop scoring.
But I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, the in cricket, obviously, the semi at Edgbaston in 1999 comes
Wimbledon
to mind.
Wimbledon 08, Nadal Federer, one of the greatest finals, I guess, of any sport, anywhere.
The same day.
Yeah,
but Wimbledon 08, that final was supposed to be one of the greatest of all time, right? One of the greatest sporting events of all time, I think.
I mean, one of the things you often find with finals is how sort of uneven they are, or how much of a kind of blowout they are, and just the better team wins. So the fact that almost neither team won this game, and you know, after 100 overs, in the last four overs, the last two overs of the run chase, and then the two super overs had more drama than most, like cricket World Cup finals.
Most cricket World Cups.
The number of things you could list that happened in those 24 balls, just mind blowing, and. Yeah, well, I guess we're all just very lucky to have either been there or to have watched it live. Comparisons are for, there'll be plenty of time for that, I suppose, and for the lists and all that. But just the magnitude of the occasion, the closeness of the finish, the extraordinary nature of some of the events, the players involved, pretty hard to top, I think.
It's a good time to mention that this is one of the reasons why live sports still continues to be that rare commodity sought after so much by commercial partners and broadcasters. It's pretty much like nothing else in today's world. Live sport is a rare commodity. You don't know what's going to come. Alan mentioned the last 24 balls. Mel, quick question. You've been to hundreds of press conferences. You've covered cricket worldwide. We've not recovered from this whole thing 48 hours later. So how equanimous and how calm is Kane Williamson at the press conference? And how did you all feel listening to him? Because when I listened to him, I felt calmer in terms of my outrage going down just by listening to him.
It's impossible to really admire him more for the grace in which he's handled everything, and the rest of the team as well. I mean, you could see afterwards they were hurting. I mean, how would you feel to not lose a game and yet told that you have lost the World Cup? Like, it's impossible to imagine. And he was so gracious. Somehow he kept his sense of humour. It was a wry sense of humour, but... You know, the way he did that was incredible. Not only that, New Zealand the next day put up a number of players and coaching staff at their hotel before they dispersed. There are a number of teams that I can imagine not doing that. If they'd just been through something so heart-wrenching like that, I can't imagine. And Kane actually spoke to media again the next morning and did the same thing. Humility, grace, everything else. Honesty as well, like he said, it was pretty tough to swallow, and all of those kinds of things. But I mean, I do think it's a cliche to say that they won a lot of hearts. But judging by some of the comments on my Twitter feed by people insisting that they are the real world champions, I think they really, really did. It's an incredible amount of fortitude, being comfortable in yourself. And also having a sense of perspective, I suppose, as well. But he was incredible. I cannot imagine any other captain now or in the past who could have handled that with the amount of grace and humour that Kane Williamson did.
Yeah, no, I wrote a little bit about from his press conference, because, you know, it was clear that, at least to me, I don't think I remember a single moment of luck, but nothing else, that has turned such a decisive game so decisively at the end, at the very death, like, you know, a couple of balls left, and this throw comes in and it hits this moving bat and it goes off in an area where there's nobody and it's gone for runs. It's just, I mean, to be able to process that and handle that and then come out. And he didn't use the word luck once. It was Owen Morgan, who, by the way, gave an exceptional press conference himself, like full of grace, full of humility as well, and full of balance, you know, the way he spoke as well, Morgan afterwards. But, you know, Cain Williams, I even asked him that, you know, it's just luck that you haven't won, right? And he refused to use the word. He was like, well, you know, there was uncontrollables and thin margins, and oh, it was one of those days. And I was like, you can't be human. Like, how can you even, you know, if it was anyone, I mean, I'm thinking about some of the more excitable captains in world cricket. I don't know. I think of maybe Virat Kohli. I think of Sarfraz. I think of even maybe Aaron Finch. Somebody would be like, you know, just going crazy at what's happened to them, because they were literally, I don't think England would have gotten, what was it, 7 off the last 2 balls? Is that what they needed after the overthrows?
It would have been 7 off 7 two off instead two, of right? 3 off 2. Yeah.
Instead of 3 off 2. I just couldn't have seen them getting it. And they were home until this throw came in. It was just crazy. And they had like little bits of luck go against them throughout the day, which, you know, they had a lot of luck helping them towards getting to the final, which is fine. But, you know, once you're in the final, it was unbelievable, you know, the way he handled it. He just smiling. He had the right answer for most things. And, you know, I began this tournament with a massive man crush on Faf du Plessis, but I think Cain Williamson has safely and firmly pushed Faf du Plessis out of my heart. And he's sitting there right now, King Cain. It was an amazing performance. And just a shout out again to Owen Morgan's performance as well afterwards. He was phenomenal in his press conference, the way he handled it.
Yeah, if you can't get enough of Cain Williamson, there's a 9-minute video of him talking to the media, which is on ESPN UK's YouTube feed. Make sure to check it out. Cain actually said he and Owen Morgan went out or had a drink together because they're good mates in the IPL. They played for Sunrisers Hyderabad. That itself says a lot about both the captains, as Usman just mentioned, which is pretty crazy, come to think of it, come to think of all the other captains that you see. And back in India, I've seen so many people on their Twitter feeds talk about, he is my captain, cool. Obviously alluding to Mahendra Singh Dhoni and Cain being the successor, whatever. So it's hard to think what Dhoni would have done, but it's such an incredible thing what happened after the final. And full credit to him in that it is completely expected of Cain Williamson to just be this. Nothing less would have sufficed, which is kind of incredible. Unfortunately, at some point, we have to move on from the final. This is a World Cup review podcast, not a World Cup final review podcast. We've had an episode already with Sid Monga and Fidel Fernando. Make sure to listen to that as well. Plugs apart, Alan, interesting cliche which almost came true, which is the fact that New Zealand's fielding almost won them a World Cup final. It's such a great aspect of their game that keeps getting underlined of late, deservedly so. They're incredible in the field. They run around, they catch every ball like it's the last one that they're going to field. Pretty insane and awesome to see a substitute like Tim Southee diving to take that catch as a Lockie Ferguson catch. Let's talk a little bit about their fielding through the tournament. It almost carried them over the line.
Yes, although ironically, it was a poor bit of fielding by one of the guys you Trent would least Bolt. Imagined yeah. would make an error like Trent Bolt did. Long on, you know, he took the catch which would win them the cup. England, I think, would have then needed 22 off 8 balls with numbers 9 and 10 out. And then, there's no explaining it, but he took that one step back. In fact, just to touch on the switch hit, which we recorded earlier, Mark Butcher suggested that the Lord Slope may have come into play here. Wow. And the fact he just slightly misjudged where he was by, you know, half a metre or a foot or two, and trod on the rope. And, you know, that was England's first six of the final. So it's kind of, baffling and kind of ironic that Bolt, who took that pressure catch at Old Trafford to remove Carlos Brathwaite when West Indies were seemingly going to pull off this incredible victory, which would have left New Zealand out with it, you know, in the final shake-up. For that to then come back and sort of be Bolt in the final, who then pulled off two pressure runouts off the final two balls when England just needed a slip from someone and get that two and they win the game. But to go back to New Zealand's fielding, you know, as a whole, the general quality, high quality that they showed throughout. Like Sharda Ugra at the very first game, Cardiff, New Zealand, Sri Lanka, obviously a very big win for New Zealand in that game, and a bit of a cakewalk. But the thing she wrote about, and one of the things I noted, like I was kind of half watching that game before I came into the office, and Sri Lanka are obviously under the pump, losing wickets,
Angelo Matthews played a brilliant pull shot, which probably would have got him four. He was on zero, and Bolt at mid-wicket dived, cut it off, prevented a single. Matthews stayed on naught. Next over got out. And it was that kind of thing that Sharda was highlighting in her piece about how, even though they were coasting the game, there were all these little moments that New Zealand were just that intensity in the field shone through. And like, you know, in the semi-final, that catch by Jimmy Neesham, off Kartik, I think, backward point. Like, I mean, that was one of the catches of the tournament, like, considering the occasion and, where, you know, how hard that catch is, one-handed, a couple of inches off the turf. So yeah, they were brilliant. Like, Williamson knew what his players were like in the field, knew he could marshal them that way. But Southee, who played one game in the tournament, like, to come and take as a sub that pressure catch off Joss Butler, which in most other circumstances would have been the catch that won them the match. They were brilliant. A credit to the high standards they've long set out, I suppose. Just a shame it didn't win them the tournament.
That
sounded a bit smug, but
it's true.
But I think one of the things, guys, is that you listen to the names you're all mentioning, and I think it's a really interesting thing to point out, is that you're nearly all talking about fast bowlers. Now, fast bowlers are not renowned for being incredible in the outfield. Like, they're not bad by any means, but to have a phalanx of fast bowlers who are just seriously good, like, not even just with the catches. Watching Trent Bolt dive around the Lord's boundary yesterday, we were just astonished he was saving some of the fours that he was. And it's the same with all of them. I mean, just to see fast bowlers put their bodies on the line, throw themselves around. I wonder if it's a bit of a legacy of the old Brendan McCullum philosophy of just putting it all on the line, because that's what I think you see from those guys. They're so skillful, so fast, and quite courageous.
And, you know, we've not even mentioned the two most electric pieces of fielding, which came from New Zealand, which was Martin Guptill's run out of Dhoni in the semi-final. And the catch that he took off Stephen Smith, Lockie Ferguson at Lords. That was a phenomenal, phenomenal catch. I mean, you know, leg gully, that was just probably, I don't know, it's up there as the top three or four catches of the tournament. For sure, I think Guptill's one to take Steve Smith out.
The one that you mentioned, the Guptill catch, is a full-blooded pull from Stephen Smith. I think it's one of his strongest shots as well. And
exactly.
And stunningly enough, Mark Waugh called it the catch of the tournament, which says as much as you want to hear about close catching. I think it's coming from one of the greats of modern day catching.
Absolutely.
And it kind of sums it up. Coming to the catching itself, while we're talking about it, there's plenty of contenders for the catch of the tournament. There's Sheldon Cottrell, there's Martin Guptill that we just mentioned, Lockie Ferguson in the final, Ravindra Jadeja. Mm-hmm. So many contenders in there. Alan, I hope you're not going to say Ben Stokes from the first game. What's your catch of the tournament?
That was a very impressive. I mean, those kind of spectacular boundary catches. I think I like Sheldon Cottrell's more, just because of the way he was like doing the 100 meters round the boundary road. Yeah. You know, sort of Usain bolting his way to grab it, throw it up, and then run outside the rope and back in. But I always tend to think that with those, you get a long time to kind of size it up. And Stokes, I think, you know, he said he'd misjudged it by being too far in, and then got himself out of it by being brilliant. So, I mean, it's hard to go past Guptill's. I do think Neesham, just because of the occasion and the fact that India weren't coming back from 5-for-3, I suppose, but 24 was also pretty decisive.
It's still pretty decisive.
I would perhaps go with that.
That's Neesham and Guptill basically so far. I'm not looking for a decisive word. I'm just hoping we mention all the contenders for the catch of the tournament. Okay, one of the things we had on our wish list in our preview podcast before the tournament was the bowlers having their say, because we just come off a bilateral series between England and Pakistan. We saw so many 350 scores. Mel, you cover cricket in England pretty much every year. You've seen these pitches, these flat bits, so to speak, producing 350s and 400s. People are asking about 500 at the captain's conference before the tournament. What do you think has contributed to these clutch of 250, 260 scores and some thrillers being produced out of this whole bat ball balance being addressed?
Well, obviously the weather played a part, particularly early in the tournament. And it was just unseasonally wet, despite what a lot of people think. It's not normally that wet in June. And also, despite what a lot of people think, June is actually the driest summer month. So there were a lot of people saying, why on earth would you have it in June? Well, it's the third driest month, I think, as far as average rainfall in the year. So, that obviously played a part in it. Some of them were weird, like that one in Durham, the way it deteriorated. That was just really odd so quickly to see a pitch like that change. In some ways, I do think you're probably lucky you haven't got George De Bell on this because he would be ranting. Oh, he would be bashing everything with a heavy roller as he threw it out into the skip. But it was disappointing. And I suppose when you look at the final, when you talk about it being the greatest game as well, I know there was a lot of heated debate going on between George and Osman in the press box about, you know, whether it was a good game, whether it was something that would draw in the eyes of fans. Because one of the ways that people in this country have really fallen in love with the England team again in the past 4 years is that they have been spectacularly entertaining games. And I suppose for people who've been watching the game like us who, you know, cricket aficionados already, we love a thriller. A low scoring thriller can be just as great as, you know, a high scoring one. So I don't know. England were very surprised at the pitches that were prepared for them. And when people say that maybe, you know, they didn't deserve to win this World Cup or whatever, it says something that they managed to win it. They were called flat track bullies quite often. But they managed to sort of dig in on a couple of really sticky wickets. So it was an odd one. And I do think the weather played a big part in it earlier on. In the latter stages, I'm not so sure. I don't know what the directives were. It's not that the ICC orders pitches to be produced of any particular kind. It's sort of left to the groundsman to try and produce a good wicket or a good pitch. Sorry, I just turned Australian for a second.
The whip is those like three little stumps.
Yeah,
on the bale.
Yeah, just yeah. I know. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's 2 for 48, not 48 for 2. I have to switch my hemisphere sometimes. So in some ways, it would have been good to see some more big hitting, high scoring games, particularly with some of the batsmen that we've seen. But you know, we did see some of that as well. We saw what Pooran could do, for instance. So it was disappointing, I think, in some ways to not get at least one like really high-scoring game. But, yeah, I don't know. It's just weird. Some of it I can't explain. I'll never be able to explain that Durham pitch and why it behaved the way that it did.
It's like the Bermuda Triangle of cricket.
No, just echoing Mel's bafflement. I wonder if even the Chestnut Street groundsman really knew what happened there.
I don't think anyone knew. I mean, Morgan said that he'd never seen a pitch like that in his life, right? I think that Morgan said afterwards he hadn't seen a pitch turn so dramatically, like from being the kind of pitch that it was to what it became. And he actually ended up playing one of the better innings in that second half of that. He actually got England, made sure that England didn't lose the advantage that Bairstow and Roy had given them.
It was from about 25 overs of the England innings.
Yeah, exactly.
Weird time. I mean, not that the big way is any more logical for it to die, but
17th over.
Yeah, it dies.
Yeah, there we go. That's your limit. 17 overs and then you're dead after that.
Whatever sorcery it was, Chesterless Street, many thanks to you for producing that Sri Lanka-England game, which kind of turned the tournament on its head. Oh, was that Leeds? Yeah.
Oh, Headingley, yeah.
That was Headingley, yeah. That was Headingley.
Alan, you were there, yeah.
Yes. That one, I think, I mean, credit to Sri Lanka. I think England played badly. I'm not sure the pitch was, I mean, it wasn't amazing. But
that early shot was...
Yeah. I mean, Melvin didn't play again after that game, but I mean, England obviously said sort of repeatedly afterwards that they felt they'd gone away from kind of the natural stroke play and all that. And it clearly it was a slow surface, but they got stuck behind the rate and then played a couple of stupid shots when and they showed they'd learned from that in the final, to be fair. I mean, Doak Stokes nearly got them over the line at Headingley. He didn't have enough assistance in the end. Obviously, they got bowled out. And this time, just about, he had people with him to the final ball and just about got them level, which showed that they'd sort of learned something from the way they approached it in Leeds. But yeah, that game, gave us the tournament it gave us,
essentially.
Right, before we come back to you, I actually caught up with our stats whiz Gaurav Sundararaman on some really interesting numbers and trends from the World Cup. Hey Gaurav, over to you.
Hi Srinath. The World Cup's finally ended and I thought I'll pull up some interesting numbers from the World Cup which everybody would want to know and some really quirky ones as well. And most of the quirky numbers come from our champion England, you know. The fact that their World Cup history is slightly not something to speak about. They've pulled up some amazing numbers this edition. So, for example, Chris Wokes and Jofra Archer. Wokes has 21 wickets and Jofra Archer has 20. And both of them find themselves in the top 7 wicket takers of England. In fact, Wokes is 5th and Archer is 6th. Which is incredible considering Archer is just playing his first ever World Cup. So that's how poor their previous editions have been and how their bowlers have not been up to the mark. In fact, highest is bottom with 30. So it's going to be pretty easy for Archer to break that over the next couple of editions. And the other interesting thing is about their batting. This stat is incredible. You know, England have 69 sixes since 1999. They scored just 69 sixes. And in 1999 World Cup, they actually scored just 4 sixes. It's unbelievable to think about how their game has changed. And this edition, they have 76 sixes just by their batsmen. So that's incredible revolution numbers here for me based on how England have gone about. And you look at their hundreds, you know. This edition, they scored 7 centuries. That's the same number that the team actually managed to previous 8 World Cups combined. And the total hundreds they have scored till the 2019 edition was 11. Again, England at World Cup throws up some extremely funny numbers where they have really nothing to talk about, which is why this win means so much to them. I can the way they celebrated, the way they have built up for the whole competition, I think it was high time they took ODI seriously and it's paid them very well. And let's look at partnerships then. If you look at partnerships, they had 11 century stands. In 1999, they had 3. In 2003, they had 0. 2007, they had 3. 2011, they had 4. And incredibly, in 2015, where we thought, okay, batting was easy, new rules and such, that they had just 1 century stand. Again, a total of 11 partnerships, century stands since 99, all broken in this year. Now, the other very, very interesting thing, this was a big surprise to me as well. Why this England team won could also be because of a team effort and lack of individual performances. The best bowling figures by an English bowler this World Cup, no 5-wicket haul, no 4-wicket haul as well. It was 3 for 18 by Mark Wood. That was super surprising. I thought not getting a 4-wicket haul and winning a World Cup, I don't think you can even imagine that. If somebody had told that before the World Cup, I don't think you'll take that. But that's a team effort for you. And then Jofra Archer, he bowled the most dot balls in the tournament. Again, amazing gun bowler, gun death bowler, and he bowls in the power play. So, yeah, the dot balls is something you would expect that time. But still, bowling the death, he still managed to do that. And if you have to guess who the most, which bowler has conceded the most sixes, again, very interesting, Rashid Khan. Before the tournament, you tell me Rashid Khan concedes most sixes? Never. I think 14 sixes, maybe 2 IPLs put together, he wouldn't have conceded so many sixes. It's that incredible. Obviously, Chahal also conceded 14, but Rashid's name stands out. Now, if I ask you, which bowler conceded most number of boundaries, that is just 4s, that would you be able to guess?
Is it a Sri Lankan bowler, Isuru Udana?
Lovely guess. You got the role correct. He is a left-arm fast bowler, but not Udana.
Oh, okay.
I'm asking you for a reason, obviously. So
it can't be Mitchell Starc.
It is Mitchell Starc. He conceded 56 fours. So that again was a pretty mind-blowing stat for me. And talking about Starc, he has the most expensive figures for Australia ever in World Cup history. Can you imagine Mitchell Starc, the World Cup's GOAT, that's what we call him, but for Australia ever, his spell against India was Australia's worst ever World Cup bowling performance. So that just shows how incredible Australia were in World Cups and opposite of England. And then Sri Lanka's highest run getter. This was again surprising. I just somehow assumed it to be Avishka Fernando, but looks like he's played very few matches. Then I thought it would be Angelo Matthews. No, but it's Kusal Pereira. Yes, he started the tournament on a high, but I didn't really imagine him to be the highest run getter. And this tournament has been full of runs for the top three. We speak so much about Rohit Sharma's, Jason Roy's, David Warner's, and it's actually been a very poor tournament for the lower middle order. You would expect them to do very well at the start of the tournament, considering the high scores, etc. But only Stokes and Carey, with only the two batsmen who had scored more than 270 runs, if you look at middle order, maybe positions 5 to 7. 270 runs, that's an average of 28 runs if you're playing 10 games, or even if you play 9 games, it's 30 runs. So it seems a bit too low, but only Stokes and Carey have managed to actually do well playing in the middle. Before I wrap up with the last couple of stats, Joe Root, he's broken a record. Not only a World Cup record, but a ODI record in this World Cup. Do you know what that is?
An ODI record? No, he made 550 odd runs in total. Has he scored the most 50 plus scores? He made 100 also. What is the record?
So it has nothing to do with his batting. He's taken the most catches ever in an ODI tournament. He's taken 13 of them. So it involves all tournaments till date, and that's pretty interesting. And a lot of our listeners might be interested in certain key numbers of the tournament. So I'm just taking you through that as well. The most dots played by a batsman, Kane Williamson. Most singles played by a batsman, Kane Williamson. Most twos, interestingly, went to Shakib. Most threes is again Kane Williamson. He's tied with David Warner though. Most fours was by Johnny Bairstow, and most sixes was obviously by Owen Morgan, purely because of that one game. Otherwise, he had some competition. So this entire World Cup has given some very interesting numbers. It didn't go as per anybody's expectation, which is why I guess the World Cup was very successful. And finally, England managed to win in terms of boundaries. So I don't know. There's no stat for that because it's the first ever time that's happening. I hope the next World Cup is as interesting as this.
Oh, excellent. Thanks, Gaurav. That's a lot of information, power-packed information, insightful stuff, which gives you a great picture of the tournament.
And talking of spin and turn, Osman, you know the highest wicket-taking spinner, what rank he's in on the wicket charts? Can you just give an approximate guess?
I would reckon maybe 13th.
Yeah, very close. Joint 17th, Yuzvendra Chahal with...
Joint 17th?
Yeah, joint 17th. Like the highest 12? Wicket-taking spinner of the tournament has 12 wickets. Yeah, 12, pretty crazy. Way, way down. I think almost all teams have a representative fast bowler above him, except maybe Afghanistan. Pretty much everyone else has at least one fast bowler above Yuzvendra Chahal, who's the highest wicket-taking spinner of the tournament. Pretty crazy.
Wow. I mean, I guess... I'm trying to remember if there was a pitch that really turned. And the only pitch that I remember, and there must have been more, that like spun big was the edge batsman pitch for the Pakistan-New Zealand game, in fact, in which literally Santner was turning it like he was, you know, Murli or Bedi. And Santner is not like a big turner of the ball, but he was turning it big. But I remember speaking to, I think, at just one of these mixed zones, there was Shadab Khan, you know, who's also had a, you know, wonderful run into the tournament. He's one of the kind of big leg spinners going. And he was kind of surprised by how some of the pitches looked like they would turn, but they didn't end up turning. And, you know, I mean, like pitch reading, I have no clue whatsoever. I think half the people who speak so confidently about pitches don't know what they're talking about and just making it up, really. You say stuff like, you know, oh, there's a little bit of grass underneath that. Oh, yeah, but it's dry underneath that. Oh, it's a little damp today, though, so it might turn or it might swing. I don't think they know what they're talking about. They're just putting words together. Apart from
learn,
the narrators, obviously.
We learn from Williamson, Osman.
We learn, in fact, as in life, so too in pitch reading, we learn from Kane Williamson. But I think like a lot of the pitches
that could
just
be your
didn't
first
have,
date, you know.
That could be my icebreaker with Williams. You know, I've learned everything.
Can we go and see some turf sample?
Oh, there's Pat. Hi, Pat. How are you doing? Join us. And you know, before the tournament, I remember when we were doing our kind of predictions way back in Jan, I remember, a lot of people said that, you know, this would be a World Cup for leg spinners because there were so many good leg spinners at the World Cup. Literally every team had like one good leg spinner there. And suddenly, like, you know, I think for a while, in fact, finger spinners were doing better than leg spinners, which nobody, I think, thought.
Nabi
and Moin had a great game against Pakistan at Trent Bridge. You know, yeah.
Shakib, I think,
Shakib,
for a while.
Of course, had a great tournament, and I'm sure we'll come to him as well. But it's weird. It had probably something to do with the weather as well. And then the condition of the pitches was kind of played into it. But I will say that it's not like they were complete flops. I think spinners played their role for almost every side at various moments. You know, Adil in the semi-final against Australia, man, those were like big, big wickets. The two that he took, especially the two that he took, Carey and Marcus Stoinis, those were big wickets. Imran Tahir picked up wickets. Shadab picked up wickets. So I think they did complement the bowling attack, but it was obviously, you know, space dominated completely. But I think spinners, not as big as we thought, but still very, very important.
Alan, a quick one to you. I just correct me if I'm wrong. I think last year around this time, because of the summer in England and the heat wave and whatnot, weren't we talking about spinners coming into their own at precisely this time of the year? Wasn't it last year?
Yes. And well, I mean, the one day is between England and India. Mm. Obviously, Kuldeep was phenomenal. England couldn't play in, I think, the T20s, and then certainly the first ODI, he took six for, and then England had got better at it. But Rashid bowled that ball that left Kohli kind of staring at the pitch. And normally around this time of year, in fact, if you're looking at like championship cricket at the moment, the spinners are taking lots of wickets, and the whole debate about spin in this country, the decline of spins, usually that there aren't enough kind of first-class games played in July, August, when it's getting warm and the pitches are drying out and all that. And then you get September and the temperature drops again and it gets all green and nibbly as it is in April and May. So, yeah, this would normally be sort of the prime time for it. It just, I think you just have to file it under that, the weird pitches anomaly, in that if the pitches were kind of flat as everyone had expected and it was 350 by 350, then the value of that, certainly a wrist spinner and the uncertainty of which way the ball might just deviate a little bit becomes greater. But when there's something in it for the quicks almost throughout, like, you know, as a kind of that Lord's pitch, Colin de Grandhomme was unhittable, and, you know, pretty throughout the day, the seamers were hard to get away. So Mitch was starting to bowl four overs or something, you know, and so they're not going to be effective if by comparison, or, you know, the seamers are so effective by comparison. Well, you know, you turn to your spinner when you have to, maybe. Yeah. And Cosman said that, I think they did have their moments, but just nowhere near as kind of pivotal as we thought.
Just on Colin de Grandhomme, Usman, another 1992 reference. He was a tribute to the New Zealand attack of the 92 World Cup. And I think Mark Elam from the 99 World Cup, one of those dibbly dobblers doing really well in a big game in a World Cup.
Amazing guy. You know, I think halfway through the England chase, I had started writing a piece on how it would be so peak New Zealand that Henry Nicholls and Colin de Grandhomme won them a World Cup final. That would be just like a tribute to all of New Zealand cricket history ever. That, you know, one stodgy batsman who's playing out of position as an opener and one dibbly dobbly all-rounder comes together and they win you the World Cup. It was just a phenomenal performance. Although, you know, a lot of people show a lot of surprise that Colin de Grandhomme bowls so well, but being a Pakistan follower and chronicler, I have seen Colin de Grandhomme, and the only teams that he has really performed against has always been Pakistan. I think he picked up a six for in one of his tests against Pakistan. It might have been his debut, I'm not sure. Yeah. He has hurt them with the bat in the past. He's exactly the kind of player who nobody else has heard of, but who Pakistanis fear. They go to sleep at night, like, just trembling that, oh my God, we're playing de Grandhomme tomorrow, what's going to happen? So I came with the benefit of hindsight in that de Grandhomme, he can win you this World Cup, guys. Just believe he can win you this World Cup.
Yeah, definitely one of those cricketers who could only be from New Zealand. I'm sorry for digressing. I didn't mean to go to Colin de Grandhomme. We were talking about spinners. All the niceties are out of the way now. I'm going to come to Mel and ask you a very controversial question. This is dedicated to Mohammad Issam, of course. Would you have given Shakib Al Hasan the player of the tournament award, Mel?
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one. I do think he was right up there. And when you look at the way he performed in so many disciplines, the amount he contributed just as one player to his team's totals everywhere, I mean, it was just phenomenal. And I did find it quite amusing. And it's, you know, it's a disgrace, isn't it, that Bangladesh can't even be given a measly little ODI series in countries like India and England and Australia. They're the bottom of the scrap heap virtually when it comes to the morsels that are handed out to them. And so that meant that there seemed to be all those people who were really surprised, like, oh, wow, this Shakib fella's quite good, isn't he? Where'd he come from? He's got a lot of potential. All right, you know, I reckon he could go all right. Not that he's been there, what is it, seven years in the last 10 or whatever, that he's been the best all-rounder or something ridiculous like that. That really struck me with even hearing various commentators talk. And that's, I guess, in a way, a great thing about a World Cup for people to suddenly see the talents that are showcased. I've only ever seen Bangladesh play in ICC tournaments. I've never seen them play in a bilateral series because – well, they've never been to any country that I've covered cricket in, mainly, and I haven't been there. So in some ways it would have been, I think, great. On the other hand, look, I'm not sorry that it was given to Kane Williamson, because you got to give the man something. I know it's a small god's like, give him something. And, you know, he was the most difficult batsman to get out the whole time. Remember Owen Morgan saying before the final, what's Kane Williamson's weakness? And he said backing up, because it was basically only Mark Wood's fingernail. Talk about luck. I mean, you know, so I'm not unhappy that it's been given to Kane Williamson, but I would not have been sorry to see it go to Shakib Al Hasan either. I think he's super, and I think that other countries should look at themselves, take a long look at themselves in the mirror, and just sort of say, what are we doing? Not letting the likes of not just Shakib, but, you know, the Fizz and Mamadullah and all of those guys who are so fun to watch. Why not get them? It's only has to be a little one day series. It doesn't have to be like, you know, the Ashes or anything. Just give them something.
But that would, I think, inviting Bangladesh to play in the Ashes would really boost their profile. it would make them interesting.
But you'd get a massive crowd for Bangladesh. For the Ashes. But if Bangladesh came here and played an ODI series here, I think they would draw a massive crowd in most parts of the country, right? I'm guessing. Like the kind of support
all the games. It was incredible. I went along. I was just picking up my accreditation, but Bangladesh, New Zealand at the Oval. It was insane.
And Mel was there at the Bangladesh Pakistan game as well, right? Which was one of the games that goes for its atmosphere.
I did a few Pakistan games because I was down there in Taunton when they played the West Indies, and I was there in Birmingham when they played India. And then for that one down there. So I did a few Bangladesh games, and for me, they were my favorite crowd. Like, they were so fun. And it's you see the you see all the guys wearing the tiger onesies and stuff, but you saw women wearing like these beautiful long tiger print dresses, everyone in the family, the whole family goes, and everyone dresses up to the nines. It's a real family and community event. A lot of Bangladesh fans, there were a lot of expats from the US who came over to watch games here because it's quite a good sort of distance for them. There was just a joyfulness to them. It was really something else, and I think they bring a lot. I remember when I saw them play Afghanistan at Manika Oval in Canberra in the last World Cup, and again, that was just astonishing. That was the first time I'd seen them play in a tournament, and the atmosphere there was incredible. Just everything in red and green. But that match against Pakistan was the best crowd of the tournament in so many ways, because it was evenly poised, so sort of equally divided. It was so joyful. And it didn't matter that it was effectively a dead rubber. They had so much fun, and Lords has never been such a sort of fun environment, I think.
Until the final, of course, when it got crazy. The one thing I remember, Mel, from your tournament, and when you and Issam, I think, kept sending videos from the grounds, there were people holding placards saying, ECB, give Bangladesh a full tour to England. And the other thing remember is I think a tweet from Adam Collins at the start of I think during the Bangladesh Australia game about the last time when Bangladesh toured Australia, the first dismissal was Justin Langer, Bold, or LBW, Master of Fame, Ortiz. That's how long it's been. It's been it's been
it's a 2008 in Australia, I think, 2010 in England, and isn't it am I right in saying it's 2003 in India?
No, they toured for a one-off test just now, but yeah.
One-day tour.
One-day tour, yeah. I don't think they've ever toured for a one-day series.
I don't think they've ever played a one-day series.
I don't think
bilateral one-day series in India.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. Because we've had in Australia, we've had like Sri Lanka touring. Are we at a point where we say that Bangladesh isn't an equally attractive or good side as Sri Lanka to come and play some ODIs? I don't think we're at that stage anymore at all. I think they're incredibly entertaining. But I know it's not seen as good broadcast-wise, but yeah, there's a huge Bangladeshi community in Australia, a big one here in England. And I have absolutely zero doubt that they would get amazing crowds in either country.
Apart from the tickets and the turnstile receipts, whatever that boards see, apart from that, just look at the numbers on digital media and you can get a sense of the TV audience in Bangladesh. It is absolutely pretty big. The fan base is huge. Alan, one last thing on them before we go ahead. Their World Cup points table position wouldn't have done them any good. They really didn't deserve to finish eighth, which is as low as it got for them.
Yeah, I was really disappointed for them. Sri Lanka played a couple of great games. Obviously, beating England was perhaps the result of the upset of the tournament. But they benefited, I think it's fair to say, from two washouts. I think Bangladesh and Pakistan would have fancied themselves to win those games. Bangladesh had only lost to the teams in the top four until that final game against Pakistan, I think. In an alternate universe, had managed to squeeze past New Zealand and got the points there. They were the only team to chase 300 plus, I think. They put up reasonably good efforts to chase against India and Australia. They collapsed a little bit against Pakistan in the end when shamefully Pakistan didn't try and win by 316 runs, but
imagine.
To top it all off, South Africa won their final game and then went above Bangladesh in the final standings as well. So, I thought Bangladesh were probably the fifth best team. Pakistan deserved that.
But they were in that clutch of teams, weren't they?
Fifth or sixth. Yeah. You know, it was between Pakistan and Bangladesh on the cusp of the top four. And somehow Bangladesh ended up below Pakistan, Sri Lanka and South Africa.
West Indies, yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was harsh on them. The points table wasn't high, but it didn't do service to how Bangladesh, how good they were, I thought.
One thing that I found really interesting too is that, I said this about Bangladesh a couple of times, and such as they just are so desperate, I think, to get recognition from anywhere as to what a good side there is. I reckon I did more interviews with Bangladeshi TV and radio before the final than most of the players did. Like, they all wanted to ask me the same thing about Shakib Al Hassan and about ODIs in other countries. So their reporters who were over here are incredibly conscious of this, and they're going around asking just other reporters if they can comment on it as well. So that was really interesting to me because they were just coming up and they just want you to tell them and confirm that you think they deserve a bit more than what they're getting from other countries.
You know, there's a thought in at the ICC, and I'm not sure. I haven't seen any numbers, and I don't think they have numbers. But there's a fairly strong school of thought within the ICC that thinks that outside the big three, Bangladesh is probably the biggest cricket economy in the world game right now. You know, they've grown to that size now. The BPL pays silly amounts of money, by the way, to a lot of these foreign players, which is why, you know, guys like AB will play the BPL sometimes at the cost of missing out on BBL stuff. So, you know, I mean, they're no longer a coming force. They are a force. The only thing I think they miss on the field, I think, and it's been a problem for them always, is they need to have one express quick bowler in that attack, I think. I think they've got a good attack. Rubel, I don't think, is that express anymore as he was like a few years ago. But they just need one guy, I think, in that attack, one really quick bowler. And that just changes the nature of that side completely, I feel.
Yeah, just on the AB thing that you mentioned, we had done an episode on this in great detail. The one bottom line figure that you need to know is what AB is paid by the BPL is 33% of a Big Bash team's budget. That's the scale of the BPL. It's pretty crazy. Wow. One player makes 33% of a BPL team's entire roster's budget, which is absolutely bonkers if you think about it. That's the scale of the Bangladesh cricket economy. Alan alluded to Pakistan. I really wanted to bring up the 92 comparison at that point. Now, the 92 World Cup, let's not forget, had 9 teams, which means 8 league games. Until the end of the 8th league game, the results went identically for Pakistan. And come the 9th game, they were in uncharted waters. There was nothing to look back to in 92, and the dreams kind of faded after that.
And they won the 9th game as well.
That was a semi, was it?
Yeah. I mean, here they won the 9th game against Bangladesh, right? That the final group. I mean, they
correct.
You know what?
Yes, the results did keep.
The results did keep adding up. They just needed a couple more. Exactly. They needed one more game. No, I think, you know, Pakistan had they had one of the great campaigns, I think, of a world tournament. In that, you know, they went low, they went high, without actually the finish of it, which would have been them in the semis, and then, you know, trampling all over India, of course, and then. Mm-hmm. And then sending England back home as well without a tournament. No, I think they did. You know, they did. I thought they might sneak into the semis. You're going to have to remind me what I said in the first broadcast that we did before the tournament about them. But I thought they were a chance to sneak into the semis because... Yeah,
the chaos was the fans. So.
But they actually, like, at core, they have a decent side. And they have the makings of a decent side. Not all of them obviously clicked at the same time. But, you know, in Babar, in Fakhar, even in Imam. And, you know, Hafiz will go now. Malik's gone. Haris Sohail was there. Safraz kind of felt like a revitalized captain towards the end of it. And then, you know, they've got guys like Shaheen coming through. Shadab is there. They've got the makings still of a decent side. But, you know, as we know, that's never the thing with Pakistan. It's always whether they can manage to put together a run at the right time in any given tournament, in any given test match. So, you know, they brought the entertainment, they brought the fun, they brought the crazy, and the world loved it for it. And, you know, Jared, of course, immortalized it in his piece where he basically said that Pakistan won the World Cup. Which, you know, they beat both the finalists, so I reckon that's a good shout.
Yeah, that's what fans said as well, just the opposite of Bangladesh. They beat 2 out of the 4 qualifiers, was it?
I think
India and New Zealand. No, they beat 3 out of 4, 2 out of 4. Australia, they lost 2. That was pretty crazy.
Yes.
Wahab Riaz almost took them over the line in that game.
Exactly.
Again,
just says
all you need to know. Yeah, Alan.
Forget the super over and boundary count back. That should have been the, you know, tied final at Lord's.
Give it to Pakistan.
Pakistan won the World Cup.
That should have been it, man.
No, it should be, how about if instead of having boundaries and everything else, basically, and forget net run rates, whoever it is, it's basically how they performed against Pakistan. That should be, that should decide it.
That's
every World Cup from now on.
England out of the World Cup.
who lost less badly?
Yes, who lost by the least?
To Pakistan.
Well, Pakistan won by what? 6 wickets against New Zealand and about
14 runs?
15 runs against England.
Against
England
would have won it anyway.
England would have won.
Badly, sorry, New Zealand.
Again, really sorry.
Yeah, but there was obviously the rained out game against Sri Lanka. Let's not forget that. While we talk about the qualifiers and the winners before we head off to the sadness of the bottom 3-4, Bangladesh has already been spoken about. How do you guys make sense of the India campaign? Obviously, post the campaign, there's been a lot of talk. There's been questions about the playoff system coming through, etc. But I personally thought that India had a great campaign, except they faltered on the day that they shouldn't have, which is the semi-final. And Osman, you mentioned this in the preview podcast, when India don't have problems, they make up their own problems, which is kind of perfect, because now there are reports in the Times of India and other places that the captaincy is going to be split. However baseless they are, there are pieces and people are reading them and starting to believe it. It's kind of a manufactured problem, and it's absolutely harsh on the campaign that they've had.
Yeah, there's talk of like rifts between Kohli and Rohit and stuff, which, I mean, you know, that kind of stuff is just it's just distraction, I guess, from the defeat. You know, I think what came home to bite them ultimately, and, you know, Kohli said it, I think, at the press conference, it was 45 minutes of bad cricket. But also, I mean, they did have a problem with the 4, 5, and 6, right, in their lineup. There was, like, the Dhoni question was a question throughout. There was a question about why Vijay Shankar was there. There was, you know, why others weren't. I think this was known about India, is that once you get past their top three, then you can kind of make headway. What didn't deserve to lose was their bowling attack, because I still think their bowling attack was probably one of the best at the World Cup. I know, you know, Kuldeep ended up not having a great game against England, I think it was. In fact, both Chahal and Kuldeep didn't have great games against England. But, you know, that was an attack that can work themselves into most situations. So, which is how they base their batting strategy. That if you get to, you don't need 360. If you can get to 320, 330, you have an attack good enough to defend that. So I think those problems came back to bite them just at the moment when they didn't need it, you know, when they needed it at least. And it happened, you know, that morning when New Zealand bowled, the weather also just played into New Zealand's hand. There was a bit of cloud around and Bolt was swinging it. Mark Henry was seaming it everywhere. You know, in those kind of conditions, luck plays a huge part as well. Sometimes you do edge delivery, sometimes you don't. You know, England, the way they opened in the final against Bolt and Henry, there was a couple of LBW shouts. Roy should have been out, really, in that first ball of the innings when the LBW wasn't given. Bairstow inside edged so many shots just past his stumps, missed the outside edge of his bat many times. You know, sometimes you catch the edge, sometimes you don't. And it is just one of those things. But yeah, like you say, India has to find kind of a problem with not finishing first. And there, you know, there's nothing really that wrong with that side. There really isn't. Apart from a couple of spots, they're probably the best Indian fielding side that we've ever seen. The best Indian bowling attack that I think I've seen, for sure, is the best Indian bowling attack. And there's a couple of gaps in that middle order and the Dhoni question, which I assume will be resolved fairly soon. But that's about it. They're still one of the best sides out there. You know, they haven't won the World Cup, but they're still one of the best ODI sides out there. 9, 8 times out of 10, they'll beat whatever opponent is put in front of them.
They only lost 2 games, right? So
exactly. They lost 2 games.
They were the best team.
They lost
less than the world champions.
England and New Zealand. Yeah, both New Zealand and England lost more games, you know, so... there's still, I think, one of the best sides going. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, we've heard so much about the swinging conditions and India's weakness, etc. All of that didn't bother me. The one thing that bothered me the next morning is the fact that Jasprit Bumrah played for India, which is quite a strange thing to feel. A world-class fast bowler who does not give away a boundary after bowling 5 good balls and outperforms everybody else and most of the fast bowlers, which is pretty unbelievable for India growing up. The last time we came to a World Cup, Venkatesh Prasad was there, there's Debashish Mohanty, there's Jawagul Srinath. India's progressed so much in 20 years that India can call Jasprit Bumrah its own, which is pretty crazy. And the whole semi-final exit, that was the only sort of, a foreboding sort of feeling after they lost that semi-final. So Jasprit Bumrah, another shout for player of the tournament, but obviously there were better contenders, including Rohit Sharma himself, 500s in the World Cup. We don't see that too often. Don't have too much more time to delve on India, so we'll move on to the other three sides. The question that I had to ask all of you, so we'll start with Mel, is who's gone back with the most problems to solve from this World Cup? Is it Afghanistan, who've got on and off field issues? Is Bangladesh, we've spoken about, sacked coach already? South Africa is the one that kind of feels a little strange now. It was a very early exit and the whole looming Kolpak crisis that's there in their cricket.
Yeah, I think the team that's going back with the worst short-term problems is Afghanistan, because it was pretty messy. And it wasn't just messy. It was such a bad look. And I guess it was highlighted by the fact that so many people have just loved what Afghanistan has brought. to the World Cup and to cricket in general, and their story is amazing. And they've brought so much hope in you know, good news expansion story, which we know we have far too little of in cricket generally, because it goes the other way. But it was all just messy, and the situation with coach, the former coach and the selector and the captain and then former captain. And it was just, I thought, unbefitting of a tournament like this, and a shame to see it just seemingly implode the way it did. But I think the team with the biggest long-term problem is probably South Africa, because there are some structural issues there that are looming that aren't going to go away. And they were, while Afghanistan did disappoint, I certainly expected a lot more of South Africa. I know they didn't have their strongest team ever there, but you talk about bowling attacks. They had had pretty impressive fast bowling attack of their own, as well as, you know, some pretty accomplished batsmen in there too. So for me, that those two were probably the most disappointing sides that I really expected more from. But how South Africa addressed this looming cold pack issue, I don't know. I mean, you see the number of South African players appearing in county cricket here growing. I don't know how that's going to get better. I fear that may be worse, get worse.
The other thing, rather, which is a silver lining of sorts, is West Indies going back from a tournament with signs of promise, without board issues dominating headlines. They've got a bunch of young guys coming through. I know they didn't win a game for a whole month. They won their first game, they won their last game, and there was nothing in between. But there are signs of promise, and there are just, you know, compared to recent ICC tournaments, it looks a little bit brighter.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, obviously, Chris Gayle will be around at the next World Cup, so that's a good sign. Yeah. I mean, England played in the Caribbean before the World Cup, and I think we're a little bit surprised at how good West Indies were. They drew that series 2-2. And you saw players like O'Shane Thomas and Sheldon Cottrell start to, you know, make names for themselves. Nicholas Pooran at the World Cup, that 100. Fabian Allen, actually, fantastic innings, and one of the catches of the tournament,
yes,
maybe, to
absolutely
end their tournament. I mean, in a slightly under the radar game, but yeah, that is very encouraging. I thought the problem this time around is that the blend between experience and kind of the promise of youth wasn't there. So they had some great young players, and they all kind of clicked. Well, the whole team clicked in the first game against Pakistan, and then they disappeared from the tournament for kind of the next seven games. And that was possibly just because, those young players didn't have the experience. The older players
were too old.
But, yeah, by and large, didn't really turn up. I mean, yeah, Gayle played, what, one innings of note against New Zealand?
Yeah.
And they lost the game, albeit that Brathwaite nearly turned that around. So I think, yeah, there were the problems of having an aging team, and the problems having a young team were both there in some respect. And they obviously only clicked, you know, on the two occasions. But there's certainly stuff, good stuff there for the Caribbean, for the people of the Caribbean, when they see their team next in action. They won the last test series they played as well, so encouraging signs.
I think we've run through most of the teams. Whatever we've not run through, we'll cover in our end of tournament awards, which we've kind of devised. Just a warning before we go into that, it's a barometer of my humor. if you listen to the names of the categories, we'll start with you, Osman, and Alan. Just a quick one on the English Weather Award for the disappointment of the tournament. What's something that you look forward to which kind of didn't end up happening?
I think I was...
Are you saying the English weather was a disappointment? Hang on.
Speaking of bright sunshine here right now.
Beautiful. I mean, you know, lush greens. Yes. You can't grow that without rain.
Beautiful.
I think just going on from the assessment of West Indies, I guess I was kind of disappointed that Andre Russell wasn't fit enough to just continue through the tournament or have a bit more of an impact. That was really, you know, the way he started against Pakistan, he just started that campaign off on such a note for them and for himself that I thought he's going to go through here and he's going to be one of the players of the tournament. And then I think, you know, just the physical issues that he's had for a while now just caught up with him. And it was kind of sad to see him literally limp off and limp out of the tournament, much like I guess the West Indies did eventually.
I think my my biggest disappointment was Australia. They were good. I was so looking forward to them being crap. And a year ago, they were on track. I mean, they'd worked for it. They'd put together a really crap team.
5-0.
They had all of the parts in place. And then, you know, a couple of months out from the tournament, they start playing well and they make the semi-final. If there was been one thing that would have been better than England winning the World Cup, it would be Australia being really, really bad at it. And, you know, English level bad at it. And that didn't
happen. Finishing eighth.
So, yeah, that will never leave me. But
why you hate Australia, Al? Why you hate Australia?
Because you hate India, Mel.
I don't hate Australia. I hate Australian.
Oh, thanks.
Go on, Mel.
Oh, look, I said this in something we did the other day, and I know it's not a very crickety thing, but I don't care. I think it's actually more important. We have got to start hosting cricket tournaments and series without producing so much waste. It was disgusting. It drove me mad throughout the World Cup. Just how much plastic, single-use plastic. You know, Sri Lanka had those wonderful kits that were made of ocean waste, ocean plastic waste, and I thought they came with a really, really good message. And I just hope that cricket boards and the ICC and also venues can really take on board that message. I was starting to get a bit like going a bit nuts with it. At the final, I was walking in, I had so many people try to give me those foam hands and those plastic clappers. I mean, why do we need clappers when we've got 20,000 people with, you know, hands? Why do we have to have this stuff? It's atrocious. People were trying to give them to me and I just turn around to them and bark, no, that's poison for the environment. They looked quite scared. So maybe I was taking it a little bit to heart, but man, we've got to do better as a sport because we're a sport that has crowds in big numbers. We play, you know, 5-day games, 1-day games all over the world. We rely on the environment. You know, to actually put on games, you've got Cape Town and Chennai running out of water. So cricket has to do its part, I think. And the really disgusting waste that I see at cricket matches just drives me bonkers. And I think we've reached a point where we know enough now that we need to put pressure on bodies to actually do something about it.
Ah, well said. I wouldn't have gone there, Mel. Point taken for sure. I think at a tournament of this scale, it becomes that much more obvious in terms of the scale of these wastes. I think there's been stuff written about it, but there needs to be a lot more urgent action. My personal disappointment was a far simpler one. It is Afghanistan's performance. I was looking forward to Rashid Khan taking the world's best on because he's not played against, I think, half of those teams before this tournament. So that was my biggest disappointment. Moving on, an easier question, if you will, the Ricky Ponting Award for the captain of the tournament. My nomination goes to Kane Williamson. Before any of you say it, Alan, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think I would come back to Kane just for the way twice he marshalled those defences of 240 in the two biggest games of the tournament, and you know he's made all the right calls. I mean, there were times when you earlier in that, I'm thinking of the group game against Australia when things went a bit weird and they seemed like obsessed with Jared wrote a piece about matchups, but like they had Santner and Ish Sodhi in the team and Williamson bowled seven overs in a row, which was a bit weird, but I thought Aaron Finch was a good captain actually as well, but I would go with Williamson, I think, on the whole.
Alan, I think, speaks for the group, Osman. I'm sure you would have the same thing to say, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Kane was there. I think Aaron Finch, as Alan also said, had a great tournament, by the way, as captain. I mean, because he, you know, as Alan so hoped for, didn't have a great team. There were many holes in that Australian side. There were many holes in that Australian side, and he just managed to bring them together, the resources that he used and the way he used them, he stuck by them. I think he was just really smart throughout the tournament. And, you know, you can't look too far beyond the World Cup winning captain either. I think Morgan had a good tournament that way. You know, there were some hairy moments, but I think his presence, he had a weird tournament with the bat himself, but I think his presence with that squad, and I think clearly how they see him and how he's viewed by them has a massive, massive influence on a lot of those players. And I think he had, you know, he won the tournament at the end of the day. I think he had a great tournament as well. I would probably go, just because he had lesser resources, I would go with Finch probably as my captain.
Well, I'm actually going to go with, it's hard not to give it to Kane, but I'm going to go with Owen Morgan because for those things Osman mentioned, but talking to the players and talking to them for a long time, I mean, this wasn't just one tournament. This is 4 years of planning after a very difficult tournament for England where it was just in tatters. And a lot of credit goes to Owen Morgan and Andrew Strauss, Trevor Bayliss, Paul Farbrace, those guys. Like they planned this a long time in advance. And all the guys, like especially the bowlers, I mean, they say that Morgan is the best who they've ever played with. And Jofra Archer said afterwards, after every ball, Owen Morgan was just coming up to him and telling him that he was doing a great job. And he said, when your captain says that, it was Liam Plunkett who said to me, Owen Morgan said, when I'm batting, I give him confidence. And he said, it's like, gives you, it's amazing. It's like, what, really? And he said in the final, when he came on to bowl, Morgan said, look, we haven't tried cross seam yet. You're best in the world at doing this in this part of the game. Do what you do. And that's, I think that is a huge part of what has got, it's what Osman alluded to. And also at the end of the game, what I thought was just wonderful and it goes beyond cricket was when he was, you know, being asked himself about luck. And he said, Adil Rashid, he said, it's yeah. Allah. Allah was on our side. Morgan said, I might call it the luck of the rub of the green. And he said, but that just demonstrates, you know, the diversity of our team, which is a great thing. That was an amazing statement to make and a really important one, I think, at a time when there's so much sort of division generally, was the way he has brought a very diverse bunch of people aside on a four-year plan. And at the end of it, they've got there, even though people might not agree on how it was decided. But, you know, I'll give it to him for that reason.
Oh, I hope you get to talk about that and more in person with him in your next big interview coming soon on ESPN.
You'll be sick of me.
Okay, just to wrap up this episode of Talking World Cup, before we sign off from the tournament, the newcomer, the breakout star of the tournament, strangely, surprisingly, for some of you watching your first or second World Cup, I'm calling it the Collins Obuya Award for the breakout star. Mel, let's start with you. A few nominees that I have in mind. Jofra Archer, of course, Avishka Fernando, Shaheen Afridi, Sheldon Cottrell. He's not really a newcomer, but he came to mind as somebody who's a breakout star from this one.
Yeah, well, Sheldon Cottrell, the thing I thought was great about him was just how many kids you saw imitating his salute. That was brilliant. Like, there was so much personality in that. And I saw him with a bunch of kids doing it at Trent Bridge. The kids loved it. They just thought it was brilliant. But I'm going to give it to Jofra Archer because to think he wasn't in that side in just a very short while ago, and to think there was the controversy about him coming in when various people were making murmurs about, you know, should England have changed the rules? Would he upset the culture? How's the culture now, eh? Hey, that's what Jofra's saying. Culture, yeah, nah. but you can't imagine. I mean, it's the thing of a movie to be handed the ball when you're the newest player in a team. Your captain to give you the ball when it's all on the line, and the courage he took to even bowl that short ball when he did, like, you know, that's an incredible moment. And I think he's a breakout star with an incredible future ahead of him.
Yeah. The strange thing about Archer, I think a couple of our writers wrote about it, is a lot of overseas audiences, like India, for example, this Big Bash, overseas audiences seem to have seen more of Jofra's nervelessness at the death in a T20 competition than people in England itself. I don't know how true that is, but Alan, he kind of seemed to be, you know, doubted, or his place seemed to be doubted a lot more, but eventually he showed what he's made of at such a young age in his career, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, he's incredibly relaxed about kind of the magnitude of everything he's done. Walking into a team in not the easiest of circumstances, almost walking up to the crease and just like flicking it out at 90 miles an hour, and like, you know, he he'd be asked as the tournament went on, like, "Oh yeah, you're doing really well. Is this a surprise to you?" And he'd be like, "Yeah, it's going all right, isn't it?" kind of thing. You've taken more wickets in a World Cup than any England bowler in a previous edition has taken. Wow. Did you expect that? Oh, I guess I didn't expect to do that well, but it's pretty cool. like asked about what's his answer. Something about do you prefer to bowl first after obviously England did at Edgbaston and kind of ran through Australia? He's like, yeah, because obviously it'd been all about batting first, getting so far on the board. He was like, no, I like to bowl and then just chill. Like, man, this guy, he's ice cold. And yeah, he bowled the most important over in the whole tournament. He bowled a ball that hit the off bail and went for six.
Yes, forgot about that.
He was incredible. I would put a little hand up for Avishka Fernando, who's I may have stolen on the thunder here, but talking of Archer, I mean, Avishka Fernando at Headingley, when Sri Lanka were like 3 for 2, walked out, and he hooked Archer for 6 twice. Just like, talk about cool. He then gave it away, unfortunately, on 49. And meant no piece is going to be written by me about you today, Avishka. And then Lasith Malinga came and did his thing. But so, yeah, I was impressed with him. And it obviously got 100 in the final game, in Sri Lanka's final game. But, yeah, Archer probably just logically and objectively was probably that guy.
Osman sounds like he's the guy who's got the definitive long lead on Avishka Fernando. Take it over, Osman.
Yeah, I just wanted to say about Jofra as well. I think he just changed the nature of England's attack. Like, England's bowling attack wasn't a bad one. It was a particular kind of an attack for ODIs over the last 4 years. But he's just given them this real lethal edge. He's a guy who can, you know, he's the kind of guy who on a flat track in England can bowl a side out for like, or at least reduce them so that they don't make more than, say, 220, 230 every now and again. You know, when he's got the skills. Like, he's got the pace, obviously, but he's got the skills. And he's just really changed the nature of that attack. And I felt like guys like Wokes, I mean, you know, Wokes is the kind of the most solid, Mr. Reliable guy they've had for forever. You'd give him the country to run, actually, but, you know, the mess they're in. But I think he even made those guys better just by being there and being at the other end.
He made Mark Wood faster.
He made Mark, Mark Wood was going somehow 91 miles an hour on average in that final, over 10 overs. 91 miles an hour was his average speed over 10 overs, in which there were at least 5 or 6 floor balls towards the end. So, you know, he just made, I think, the rest of the attack just so much better. So he obviously, you know, anyone would say that he was. But yeah, like Alan has stolen away the choice that I had. Avishka Fernando, my eyes lit up when you mentioned him. It's just going to end in tragedy, though, isn't it? Because he's so beautiful. He's so good to watch. I saw him maybe 3 or 4 times, and mostly on television. And I was like, you know, who's Babar Azam? Like, Bobby Prince can go and hibernate. I've got Avishka Fernando now. And just everything about him was just so good. And it's too good to be true. And we're going to have to call up Andrew Fernando here and see what his fatalistic take is. But Avishka Fernando is going to find a way. And Sri Lanka cricket is going to find a way for him to not be like one of the best batsmen over the next 10 years. And that's only going to make me love him more, of course. So Avishka Fernando for me, ultimately.
We've not even gotten to Jofra Archer's tweets. Oh my God, the tweets over the last 5 years. 16 of 6, wanted a super over. He wrote the script. We didn't need this tournament. We didn't need these Spotify days. You could have just read Jofra's timeline and summed up the World Cup in whole. He knew all of it before. He just didn't predict that boundary countback. Thank you, Jofra. Thanks for that tournament. And thanks to you, Mel, for joining us on this podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, guys. I'm off to sleep now.
Thanks, Osman. Thanks, Alan. See you guys.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thanks,
and thanks, of course, to you, listener, for making this podcast what it has been over these 8 weeks. Thanks for your company and look forward to bringing you more podcasts from beyond the World Cup very soon. Until next time, then, this is Srinath Sripad signing off on behalf of the entire ESPN Cricket Program. See ya.